fear itself. Those are the bells of victory ringing on VE Day in Westminster Abbey, London. Those are the bells of yesterday. They're only one of many sounds and voices you will hear, telling again the events of that happy time and events less jubilant which have happened since. For this is a program about that yesterday 5 years ago, but also about today and fear and tomorrow.
United Nations Radio presents Fear Itself, a special program narrated by Martin Gable.
This is yesterday, May 8, 1945. Soldiers on the battlefronts of Europe rest their guns. In the Pacific, there's no rest yet for the fighting man. But across the other half of the world, bells are ringing. Streets are filled. Phone lines jammed. Bomb shelters empty. Where were you 5 years ago? Turn the dial of your radio back to the night of May 8, 1945. You place it? I remember well enough where I was. In a radio studio. We were celebrating in our own way.
We're gonna tell the postman next time he comes around that Mr. Hitler's new address is the Berlin Burying Ground. Round and around Hitler's grave, round and around we go. Gonna lay that feller down so he won't get up no more. Hitler went to the Russian front where every bullet missed him, but he caused a dose of Stalingrad that spread all through his system. Round and around Hitler's grave, round and around we go. Gonna lay that feller down, he won't get up no more.
There are many variations on this melody tonight. Many a different tongue and tune saying the same thing. The Serbs would refer to it as and the Danes. The Greeks have a word for it.
Giro stomni matu, Hitler giro giro, pername, pername.
Yes, and the note of triumph was echoed by Frenchmen, Dutchmen, Englishmen, Russians, in city and village and farm. Listen now to the real thing. For joy is good to hear again, good any time. Let us now, following geographical progression, go east first and work west with the clock. Between Moscow on the east and Guam in the west, there arcs a latitude of joy and comradeship half a world wide. A chain of linked hopes, hurrahs, and hallelujahs. Listen to the sounds of Moscow back then, in the good old days. V.E. Day plus one. Here is the English-speaking announcer in that city as he opened the microphones on what sounds like a steady roar, but is actually the sound of 2,000 saluting cannons intermingled with the bells of the Kremlin.
Listen now to 2,000 guns proclaiming Russian Victory Day.
Moscow, Red Square, Russians yelling, dancing in the streets, mobbing the American embassy, grabbing GIs, hugging them, tossing them into the air, toasting them in English and in vodka. 5 years from this time, Stalin's photograph, on display with other stills outside a newsreel theater in New York City, will be attacked by an angry customer. Americans will be strictly unwelcome in Moscow. But on VE night, the world listens eagerly to the Soviet leader when he comes on the air. The great day of victory has come, he says. Fascist Germany has been brought to her knees by the Red Army and the troops of our allies. The period of war in Europe has ended. The period of peaceful development has begun. Now a British lady, visiting in Moscow, brings her husband's greetings to the Russian people in this hour. Her name is Mrs. Churchill, and her husband has asked her to say...
It is my firm belief that on friendship and understanding between the British and Russian people depends the future of mankind.
The Muscovites dance, cheer, pray, weep, sing songs of their own, songs of their comrades in arms. They even try Tipperary, and it comes over the short wave with only the slightest accent of speech and atmosphere. It was a long, longer way to Berlin for the Russians than it ever was from anywhere to Tipperary. But on the night of victory, radio gets there fast enough. It brings the voice of Howard K. Smith, speaking to the combined American networks from among ruins representing combined American-British-Russian marksmanship.
A bronze bust of Hitler with a bullet hole through its forehead lay in the dusty ruins down in the cellar. The Fuhrer's garden had apparently been fought for, too. There was not a patch of green on its pocked, scarred surface.
Not all is destruction in the city. Some building is being done this very day.
Now, right in the middle of the map of Berlin, in the Tiergarten, a monument is being erected. It was half finished this morning when we passed. It's a tribunal of many columns, and in Russian characters on each column is printed the name of a Nazi victim. Austria, Czechoslovakia, Norway, Denmark, and so on. It's a monument to the United Nations, and it's Russian.
On this day, everybody on the winning side is patting everybody else on the back. Even the inmates of Belsen add a trembling note of thanks for liberation. A British commentator calls it one of the most touching experiences of the day.
Perhaps the most touching was the playing of God Save the King in our honor on the rickety and out-of-tune piano in the SS canteen which the liberated prisoners have taken over. Listen.
Also in Belsen, there is other significant music. A British chaplain holds a Jewish service, for freedom of religion has come with the liberation. A handful of Jews have strength to sing. BBC man, some 35,000 corpses around him, describes the place on VE Day.
When we reached the camp, there were 35,000 corpses on the ground. In the first days of liberation, thousands more died, many of them from sheer joy at liberation. We were burying them in mass graves. One I saw was not quite so large as a tennis court and 20 foot deep. It was half full. For the first two or three days, the burials, even on this scale, could not catch up with the deaths. It was hard to tell between the living and the dead. People lay down and died before your eyes. A skeleton amidst the skeletons would suddenly begin to move and crawl away.
He takes some Dutch children from the camp, takes them as far from the corpses as he can get, 50 yards into a grove of pines and young birch trees, and there they sing. Everybody who has enough strength sings. These Dutch kids, just out of prison, voice their appreciation to the British soldiers who've liberated them. The English, the words say, long live the English.
Long live the labor, long live the labor, long live the labor in the glory, in the glory.
ABC, standing amid corpses, the speciality of the Nazis, asks some questions.
What is the meaning of these things? What are we to do about them? These questions are not easy to answer. I have seen at first hand the horrors you have heard and seen at second hand. We must revenge these things. We must, in a great act of world justice, punish and trample upon this evil. We must harden our hearts to mercy. We all feel that. But there is something else. We must not wreak indiscriminate vengeance.
He's certain of one thing.
The camp, when it has been finally cleared, will be burned and blotted from the face of the earth.
It is still to be there in 1950, with DPs living in it. But we're getting ahead of our story. Our little chapter in history moves on now to Paris on that VE night, 5 years ago, to a city where people know how to celebrate. Rockets rise from the city of light, red, white, and blue. On the streets, GIs line up in snake dances, go surging up the Champs-Élysées, on and up to the Arc de Triomphe. The singing comes into the great circle from all directions, from all the spoke-like avenues. Now, westward across the beaches of Normandy, across the chop and rip of the channel, the tide of jubilation sweeps to Britain. Westminster Abbey sounds her bells. In Piccadilly, Trafalgar Square, all over London town and the British Isles, there's gaiety. Now the people stop in their merriment and listen silently to the voice of their king.
There is great comfort in the thought that the years of darkness and danger in which the children of our country have grown up are over, and please God, forever. We shall have failed, and the blood of our dearest will have flowed in vain, if the victory which they died to win does not lead to a lasting peace founded on justice and goodwill.
The words are for Britain, but their meaning is for the world. And so is the hooting of the ships in the harbor of Liverpool and Merseyside and Hull. Now Tommy Atkins throngs in hollering thousands to Whitehall. He knows whom he wants to hear now. Listen to the BBC commentator.
And now, oh, what wonderful luck. At this moment, Mr. Churchill has come out onto the Ministry of Health balcony.
It's the same PM who earlier in the day announced to his countrymen the news of victory and paid special tribute to his two great allies, to America and the West.
The overwhelming power and resources of the United States of America.
And then a salute to the Russians in the East.
Our heroic Russian comrades, whose prowess in the field has been one of the grand contributions to the general victory.
And from Paris, British Air Marshal Cunningham first praises the American Air Force, then, addressing the combined air forces of the United Nations, points to the future with a sense of prophecy.
You are in truth a total of 12 nations, but how happily and successfully we have worked as one. If and when you are worried at world events, remember our year together and its triumphant ending, and draw strength from what you have done.
His words tumble down the years. And if and when you're worried at world events, remember the years together and our triumphs. And tonight we are worried, Marshal Cunningham. And we are trying to remember. But we're still back 5 years ago, and rejoicing sweeps across the Atlantic like a tidal wave to the very pavements of Times Square.
To our right, in front of the Times building, a large crowd is gathering. It seems to be growing larger by the minute. A lot of people are up there watching the various bulletins which are being posted upon the windows. We can see people looking from windows.
The city's best-loved voice, now testy, now cajoling, cautions New Yorkers that fighting may still be going on in parts of Europe. And is certainly continuing in the Pacific.
Perhaps they're fighting someplace. I don't know. You don't know. Why be childish about it? Now let's be patient for a few hours, and then let us commemorate it in a way fitting. A great people of a great democracy having millions of men still at war in the Pacific.
And in the nation's capital, the new commander-in-chief, only a few weeks in office.
This is a solemn but a glorious hour. I only wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to witness this day. We must work to bind up the wounds of a suffering world, to build an abiding peace, a peace rooted in justice and in law. We can build such a peace only by hard, toilsome, painstaking work. By understanding and working with our allies in peace as we have in war.
Northward from Washington, in the city of brotherly love, America's best beloved bell tolls again. Its voice is cracked.
From the historic shrine of American Liberty, Independence Hall in Philadelphia, you have just heard the seven strokes of the Liberty Bell. The bell which tolled out the word of America's freedom back in 1776. The bell which since then has marked each historic step of American history. And today the Liberty Bell rings out again, this time to proclaim to the world freedom for the occupied countries of Europe.
And back in New York at Fordham University, Father Gannon offers a prayer in warning and in hope. Behind him, waiting, stands a chorus ready to sing the Te Deum.
Peace is not an automatic blessing that comes when the guns have been silenced. It is a task that has to be wrestled with. God grant in his mercy that this hour of splendid victory will prove in time to have been the first step toward a still more splendid peace.
Te Deum laudamus.
In Cleveland, the shining promise of peace makes people silent, makes friends of strangers.
We saw men coming together, total strangers, and most of them in work clothes, going to or coming from their war jobs. Well, they smiled at each other, shook hands silently, and just went on their way.
The farther westward you go, the more you realize VE Day is not the end, just a pause. Toward that final end, in San Francisco, the United Nations are charting the course for the future this very day. One of the men whose minds are on tomorrow is General Smuts of South Africa.
Here in San Francisco, the United Nations hope to work out a plan which will, we trust, succeed in laying the broad foundations on which an enduring peace with justice and honor can be built for the world in future.
There's the word of today for the world of tomorrow. Peace. With justice and honor. How to build it? The MP guard at the conference hall has a recipe.
Stick all the delegates in one room and leave them fight it out until it's all over and settled.
6,000 miles beyond that, a tired newsman sits in a radio shack on Guam. No bells, no speeches, no torn paper, not even prayers. Just wondering, he says.
Wondering once again if people are making fools of themselves. Unintentionally, but hopefully. That is the reaction here. No one wants to be fooled anymore in the Pacific. I think I speak for every man down here when I say, thank God if it's over there, let us hope we can get together now and finish it over here.
And the day ends thus. Not with a bang, but with a wonder. The celebration is over, but not the war. 3 months from victory in Europe, 2 atomic bombs are dropped on Japanese cities, and by the time the poisonous mushrooms of both have been pulled apart by high-flying winds, 120,000 people are dead of the effect. And then inevitably, the surrender. Aboard the Missouri, the masters of Japan stand ready to sign on the dotted line as the supreme commander of the Allied forces in the Pacific says into a microphone,
"Representatives of the major warring powers to conclude a solemn agreement whereby peace may be restored."
And so, World War II is, on paper at least, officially ended. But as someone said on VE Night,
"Peace has a mind of its own and doesn't follow victory around. What is two-thirds finished in Germany won't be three-thirds finished in Japan."
The peace of 1945 certainly has a mind of its own. And it's a neurotic mind, soon to develop symptoms. Not immediately, but soon enough. In the Middle East, a new war is brewing. In China, civil war. Indonesia, revolution. India, religious massacres. Crises in the Balkans, South America, Iran. But above all, snags running east and west. A spy trial in Canada, another in Bulgaria. Objections, complaints, a split in the voting at UN, not yet become chronic. And then, right down the middle, in the hot inner circle of fear itself, the reminder midway through 1946 that something new has been permanently added to the classic instruments of violence and death, the first experimental A-bomb. Tens of millions tune their radios to Operation Crossroads in the Pacific, where aboard an American battleship, the seconds to zero hour are counted off amid excitement and confusion.
Firing time.
How it will sound?
20 seconds.
We do not know how it's going to sound, but 42,000 men here are watching, tensely awaiting that explosion.
Firing time.
All of the observer ships.
10 seconds.
All of the observer ships are in position in the open sea. We're about 10 miles away.
Fire the other target. 4, 3, 2, 1.
The great executioner roars its warning.